Hello and welcome to this episode of Last Born in the Wilderness. I'm your host, Patrick Farnsworth. Before we jump in, please consider supporting this work through Patreon, patreon.com/lastborninthewilderness. Go to that website. You can join for a dollar or more a month. By doing that, you'll gain access to these interviews before I release them to the public. There's other exclusive content. You'll also gain access to the Discord server, and there's some very lively, very good discussions that are being had there. Also, if you have any thoughts that you want to share with me and the listeners of the podcast, you can do that by leaving a voicemail at a phone number that I've set up, and that phone number is 208-918-2837. Leave a message up to 3 minutes in length, and if you just want to send me your thoughts and not have it featured on the podcast, please state that in the message so I can know whether to feature it on the podcast or not. That's it, everybody. Enjoy the episode. Meteorologist and geoscientist Nicholas Humphrey returns to the podcast, sharing his insights into the various catastrophic, record-breaking heat waves and weather events currently playing out in numerous regions across the planet. He explains how the complex dynamics of anthropogenic climate disruption is quickening the pace of these events, and in turn, how ill-adapted and ill-prepared we are in addressing the realities of this predicament. And when I say we, I'm talking about specifically the governments and various institutions and structures that we operate within. We're not well adapted to these rapid shifts in the climate system. It's worth noting that since I had Nicholas on last time, which is about 2 years ago, I believe, he is now a second-year PhD student in emergency management and disaster science at North Dakota State University. So he applies some of this research, this work he's doing as a PhD student, to what we're discussing in this episode. What does it mean when a disaster occurs, you know, major flooding or heat waves or whatever, you know, is currently playing out right now around the world? And there are many of these types of events currently playing out as we speak. How do societies, how do communities, how do cities and various other localities respond to these things? You know, how do we adapt to them? Is it purely reactive? Is it adaptive? Is there any mitigation involved in this? I would really like people to go and support Nicholas, if you're capable, to go to his Patreon, patreon.com/meteorologistNickHumphrey. So go support his work there. You can also follow him on Facebook. His page is called Meteorologist Nick Humphrey. I'll be putting a link to that as well. So please go support Nick if you have the ability to do so. Follow him on social media. And thank you all so much for your attention. Here's my interview with Nicholas Humphrey. All right, Nick, how many times have you been on the podcast? Is this your fourth time?
Yeah, I think it's my third time, because I was on in 2019 after the flooding in Nebraska and Iowa, and then again, sometime in 2020 or 21. I think it was 21, maybe.
Yeah. It's hard to remember anymore. Yeah. I don't know. I think especially the pandemic, it feels like time doesn't exist. It's either really feels like it's speeding up or it's slowing down.
Yeah.
I don't know what's going on anymore.
Crazy.
Yeah. But I'm glad to have you on again. I've been wanting to feel like a subject that I haven't talked, I feel like I haven't talked about and focused enough attention on lately has been the climate. I've been focusing on more social issues and political events and things that are happening, which is important as well, of course. And in light of that, I just want to mention today is the 24th, and you know, I got a notification today that the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, which we knew was going to happen.
Yeah.
So, speaking of political and, you know, social issues, that is obviously a big deal, particularly for those that are able to get pregnant, for women, of course. So anyway, so that's happening in the background, but we're going to be talking about climate today, and I've been doing a couple interviews lately talking about kind of the big picture of climate, of the massive changes that are underway on the planet. Today with you, I kind of wanted to do a weather report of sorts to kind of go over I just feel like there's so many stories that are popping up about these, you know, incredible heat waves, you know, whether talking about like South Asia, like in India and Pakistan, or heat waves here in the continental U.S. in North America or in Europe, or, you know, flooding in Yellowstone. I mean, there's just like, it's just one thing after the other. And so I really just want to get an overview. Of course, you track this very closely, to get an overview of all these climate or these, you know, major weather events, climate events that are happening around the world. Yeah, I guess I could start with just asking, I mean, what are some of the major trends that you feel that we need to maybe pay attention to the most and probably try to comprehend and understand the most right now?
Yeah, so it's kind of funny because I, before I came on the show, on the podcast, I was going to look at some random news stories just about, you know, weather events that have been going on. There's like a laundry list. It's like so much happening. It's almost impossible to remember it all. Cause I mean, we have the, of course, summertime in the Northern Hemisphere. So we have all these incredible heat events that are really striking parts of the US, Europe, Asia has been dealing with them since March and April. The pre-monsoon heat in parts of India has been quite extreme. The Middle East is dealing with extreme heat with temperatures over 120 degrees Fahrenheit in a few places.
Yeah.
But then you go back even a little bit farther in time in terms of months, and you had Madagascar hit with multiple tropical cyclones, and they've been dealing with a multi-year drought in that part of the world, and which has been causing issues with food security, food insecurity, and crop failures and problems feeding people. So and also in Alaska, I've been hearing about fires that are going on. I think parts of Siberia are having big fires again as well. Mm-hmm. So I mean, there's a lot going on, and it's kind of one of those things where you look at the, you know, you talk about how you've been talking to a couple other scientists, looking at the big picture. Obviously, weather, you look at these individual events and analyze these individual events. But the big picture is this global climate change picture, where you have this global average increase in the planet's temperature, and all of these cascading effects through the system, where you get more drought, more heat, and the feedbacks on each other. You know, more drought can cause more heat and cause more drought. That causes all of these problems with fires and everything else. It'll be interesting to see how the fire season plays out in, say, California later this summer and fall. A lot of drought in the western U.S., especially the Southwest, because of the La Nina pattern. And conversely, there's a lot of rainfall happening in parts of Australia because of La Nina, a lot of flooding rains and everything else. So there's a lot going on. And then there's hurricane season too, where they're expecting an above average hurricane season in the Atlantic, partly because of La Nina, abnormally warm water temperatures in the Atlantic and the Gulf of Mexico. So there's a lot of risk for events where you could have landfalling hurricanes that can obviously cause disasters and catastrophic impacts to people and ecosystems. There's a lot going on in the world right now, unfortunately. I mean, the most recent thing has been the heat in Europe, which has been pretty spectacular. I mean, they've been getting record-breaking temperatures over, you know, well over, you know, 100 degrees in parts of Spain, France, Germany. I know there was in northern Russia, I think it was about a couple hundred miles north of the Arctic Circle, there was a record high temperature set in a community, an all-time record high temperature of about 90 degrees up far north of the Arctic Circle. And I mean, the thing with the Arctic is that just because there's so much sunlight up there, it can get hotter than most people think it can get up there even in the middle of summer. But obviously it's reaching record levels up there again. And all that heat speeds up sea ice melt, which causes, you know, more dark ocean, which causes more warming. Mm-hmm. And you can see that locally in individual events, but also the long-term average temperatures in the Arctic are rising much faster than the rest of the planet because of the loss of sea ice as well. So, yeah, heat is like the thing you can connect the most to global warming for reasons that are obvious. It's the warming of the planet. So you're getting obviously places that are warming, but some places are warming much faster than other places.
Yeah. Do you feel that the, I'm trying to think of how to say this, like the amount of heat that's been emitted over the past, well, we can look at the span of the, since the Industrial Revolution, of course, that's a pretty, it's a bigger scope to look at, but just in the past several decades, it just feels like the amount of heat that's been, the amount of carbon in particular that's been emitted, it's just really starting to, I feel like we were starting to get indications, almost like a tapping at the door, like this is kind of what the future is going to look like. This is maybe some seemingly anomalous weather event occurs or something like that, you know, in the past several, over the past several decades. But now it just seems like it's just ramping up almost to the point where, you know, you're talking about the beginning of this interview, looking at the laundry list of extreme weather events around the world, it's like, it's hard for us to even comprehend and to make sense of all of it, right? It's just happening so quickly. It's almost like there's an amplifying effect here. It's like, it's picking up pace. Do you think that that's a trend that you're observing, is just the pace of change is increasing?
Yeah. I mean, I would say so. I mean, you could look back to the 1970s, 1980s, you had, you know, rapid industrialization of China, India, places that have lots and lots of people. And obviously there has already been heavy industry in the Western world decades before that. And then in the 1980s, you started to see these accelerations and trends. So basically around the time I was born in 1984, so around the early to mid 1980s, you started seeing these accelerations and trends. The global average temperature started rising faster. Sea ice extent started to fall faster as you looked decade to decade. Trends, land ice glaciation started to decline, much of the acceleration and loss of land ice. So everything started to accelerate. And then El Ninos have become more intense. So you're getting these more intense El Ninos. We had it, you know, there was an intense El Nino in the early 80s, and then you had another one in the late 90s that made a lot of news and kind of brought El Nino into the forefront of people's minds. Like, the average person didn't really care about or know about much about, like, El Ninos until the 1997 El Nino event. The biggest concern people have had is about, like, how does this affect individual events? So scientists are still trying to figure out if there are more hurricanes or if they're more intense because of climate change now than they were in the past. It's kind of a hint, hints that may be the case, but it's still really early. But heat, the heating of the planet, the anomalous heat waves, being signaled by what's going on in the Arctic, even the Antarctic, and then obviously in the tropics and and mid latitudes, you're seeing these heat events that are much more extreme than they would have been otherwise, given climate change. And I mean, we saw what happened last year. I mean, you live in the, I think it was before you, just before you moved to the Pacific Northwest, Northwest saw about a year ago now, actually. I looked back at my memories on my Facebook meteorology page and saw that I was talking about the coming of heat event that was going to be hitting the Northwest this time a year ago today. It would be I think a year ago next week that it actually hit. That was incredible. I mean, as somebody that lived in, I grew up in Seattle in the 80s, 90s, 2000s, to see something like that was absolutely unbelievable to me, to see that kind of heat. I mean, meteorologically, it's easy to explain just in terms the development of a heat wave. You know, we talk about heat domes, and they're basically just intense high pressure systems that sit in the same place for days at a time. You know, it could be a week or more even, and you can get, what can happen is that you can get these patterns called blocking patterns, where a high pressure system becomes strong enough, it breaks off from the main jet stream. So it's like a breaking wave. It breaks off from the main jet stream and just circulates on its own, sitting in the same place for days at a time and just heating, keeping the air clear and heating the area under it. And but some of these high pressure systems have been extremely strong, and so they already have this extremely anomalous feature. And then in a climate changed world where the global average temperature is warmer than it would be, and the regional temperatures are warmer than they would otherwise be, say 200 years ago, then you get the recipe for an intense, long-lived heat event that can kill lots of people. And I mean, hundreds of people died in that heat wave. I think in British Columbia, I think, did a good job of accounting for some of the heat deaths that occurred. And I mean, the total between, you know, British Columbia, Washington, and Oregon was in the hundreds in terms of the number of people who died of heat stroke in those areas. So, I mean, that's just in a place that's fairly, well, that's well industrialized. You know, there's lots of like air conditioners, cooling centers, but not necessarily everybody has access to them. Some people are poor. Some people can't necessarily get to places, or they have to work and can't leave. And they work in places that are hot, or they're homeless. You know, homelessness is a big inhibitor to your capacity to be able to get somewhere and escape the heat. And the heat is kind of a nefarious hazard, because it's not like a tornado. Like a tornado is this individual structure that you can have an opportunity to avoid, or you can shelter in place to try to escape the destructive power of it. Whereas heat is associated with temperature, which is associated with air, which is everywhere. So it's both a hazard that a lot of people don't appreciate. You know, they don't appreciate how serious heat can be to their bodies, because they're around air all the time. So, you know, it gets hot. It's summertime. It gets hot, you know. This is particularly an issue in, say, Phoenix, Arizona, which deals with heat all the time. They, people know what to do to avoid when they start getting extreme for Phoenix standards, like, you know, upper 110s, low 120s, you know. What do you do to escape the heat? But it's also a hazard that, because it can be permeating everywhere, it's outside your house, inside your house, maybe you don't have air conditioning, then it can sneak up on you and harm you really bad. I've suffered heat exhaustion before. It's not fun.
No.
It's not fun at all. And it was during a heat wave in Minneapolis in 01 where a football player actually died of heat stroke in practice, Minnesota Vikings. I remember that in 01. And, yeah, so I mean, it can sneak up on a lot of people and do a lot of harm to people.
Right. Yeah, you know, you mentioned the heat wave in the Pacific Northwest. I wasn't living here yet, but I had been visiting for a few weeks. So I arrived right when the heat wave began. So I had the experience of knowing. I mean, I had been to this region before, of course, and I knew what it was supposed to feel like. And then having it was over 100 degrees Fahrenheit for quite an extended period of time. It was very weird. It felt very surreal. And yes, you know, lots of people died because you have houseless people, you have people that just don't have air conditioning. They may live in, like, I just moved out of an apartment on the fifth floor of this apartment complex. And during the winter, it's nice because everybody's heat is on below you. It goes up to the higher floors, and you don't have to pay for that. But we were like, we need to get out of here if there's another heat wave, because I don't think there's air conditioning. There might have been. I don't remember if there was or not in that apartment. But, you know, just the infrastructure that we have already is not equipped to deal with these massive heat events, these heat waves in regions that have not really had to deal with those before. And so, yeah, the Pacific Northwest, you know, it's just, it's a fairly like cool, wet environment throughout pretty much the entire year. So yeah, we're just not really equipped for it. And even regions that are more tropical, that are more, that deal with, you know, heat more, I mean, they're dealing with extreme heat. And I know I had shared with you an article It was published in Wired. The title of that is India Isn't Ready for a Deadly Combination of Heat and Humidity. And this gets into, I mean, it profiles, I think, at least one worker in India. I don't know exactly where, but an a worker who is a construction worker, just describing what the conditions are to be working outside in India during these weeks-long, you know, heat waves that they've experienced, and just how unbearably warm it is, and how also, you know, you would think you'd have a bit of a break from that at night, right? When the sun goes down, it should cool off, but they're seeing in these regions like India and Pakistan and elsewhere that during these heat waves, it doesn't actually cool off at night all that much. So you're not really getting a break from it. And there's this phenomena called wet bulb temperatures, which is this, as the title of this article suggests, is a deadly combination of heat and humidity. So it's not just that it's extremely hot, it's also that it's extremely humid. And so I would ask you if you could describe this, what this is, what is, I think we maybe have talked about this in the past or may have been brought up in other interviews on the podcast, but I do think now that we're experiencing these heat waves more and more frequently, it's important that people understand some of the dangers of extreme heat and humidity. If you could describe what the wet bulb temperature phenomena is.
Yeah. So wet bulb temperature in meteorology is the minimum temperature that the air can fall through evaporative cooling. And so this becomes important for animals that cool through evaporative cooling, through sweating. Because if you're unable to cool your body sufficiently, then the heat balance is off and it builds up in your body and can cause organ damage. You know, basically, I mean, that's what heat stroke is damage to your organs from getting too hot. And so it's been theorized that the maximum wet bulb temperature for human survival for anything more than a few hours is around 35 Celsius or 95 Fahrenheit. So that's the so you could get that, you know, from obviously 95 Fahrenheit, 100% humidity, or you could get it through a temperature that's higher and humidity that's lower. But the getting that hot is extremely dangerous for humans' ability to survive. And and I actually earlier today I went on my weather page on Facebook and looked at an old post that I did last year after the heat wave was over, where I had actually calculated the wet bulb temperatures for a bunch of locations in the Pacific Northwest after the event. And most of them fell in the range of the 20, maxed out around 25 to 28 Celsius. So that's the mid 70s to the low 80s in terms of wet bulb temperature. And I mean, people that were there, it was unbearable.
Yeah.
People were suffering. And then some people obviously died in some cases, maybe in their homes, because it got even hotter in their homes than it was outside. So you don't need the 35 C. I mean, if the planet were to warm really extreme to like, I saw one study some years ago. It was like more than a decade ago. Someone did a modeling of what the world would look like at 10 C. Because I mean, some of the most extreme climate models at the time were like projecting like 9-10 degrees C of global warming. And much of the tropics would just be roasted. I mean, there would just be no ability for anyone in the tropics and much of the subtropics to be able to survive, because it would be widespread temperatures at or exceeding wet bulb temperatures at or exceeding 35 Celsius. But you don't need to get to 10 C to start having some of those like really extreme heated wet bulb temperatures hit individual parts of the planet, and you don't need to get to 35 C wet bulb to see people dying, because I mean, that's just like the most healthy of people. Mm-hmm. But people that aren't healthy or older or younger or have other issues, even medications that make them more heat sensitive, they take mm-hmm. them, it makes them more heat sensitive, they can drop in that kind of heat. Where the wet bulb temperature is 28 Celsius or 29 or 30 Celsius. I've seen values of 30, 31 Celsius occur before in like the United Arab Emirates or Qatar, these places that are near the Persian Gulf, where the Persian Gulf gets extremely hot. And you can get hot during the day. It's dry heat, but then you get an onshore flow where you get this moisture that comes off the Persian Gulf, and suddenly the humidity spikes mm-hmm. and your heat index and your wet bulb temperature spike, and it gets extremely hot for a short period of time. And I'm sure people in those mm-hmm. countries retreat to their homes and try to turn out whatever air conditioning mm-hmm. they have and try to survive. But I mean, you're talking about how you didn't have air conditioning. I didn't have air conditioning growing up in Seattle either. And I mean, I remember the first time Seattle ever recorded a temperature of 100 degrees, a triple digit temperature, was in 1994. I think it was July 1994. And we didn't have air conditioning. And I mean, it was hot in the apartment. Yeah. Like my dad had to like put up pieces of cardboard to block the heat, the sun mm-hmm. from the windows. And we turned on fans, had all the windows open. It was crazy. And then I was actually in Seattle during the summer of 2009. So I was going to the University of Nebraska, but I didn't. I came back home for the summer, and they had the heat wave that was the preceded in terms of records, preceded the heat wave last year in terms of record setting, was the summer of 2009, where we had a record, all-time record high of 103. And that was unbearable. Seattle keeps getting hit with more, and the whole Pacific Northwest is really starting to ramp up, seeing more heat events, more drought. I remember going to Seattle in February of, I think, 2015, just to visit my family. And getting off the plane and getting on the bus to leave SeaTac Airport, and I looked at the mountains, and it was just barren land because it was drought. So there was no snow over the entire winter, and it was just like the glaciers that were there in barren land on the Olympics. It was just like snow. So I've had those kind of periods where it's just where you're just kind of looking at things and you're like, wow, this is really happening. Yeah. Things are really changing, you know. And you know, it's one of those things where, you know, you have a season or two where the snow comes back, where the rains come back, where the heat doesn't come, where maybe you have a season, maybe you go a year without any real incredible extremes of any kind, but then they always come back again, and they come, and it seems like they come back with a greater ferocity than they did previously. And That's kind of the way I almost describe climate change to people. It's like gaming the system to more extremes compared to what we experienced in the past. You know, mm-hmm. growing up in Seattle or growing up where you grew up, you know, you know what the weather is expected to do. You know, occasionally there's these extremes. There's flooding. There's heat. There's you know blizzards. There's this and that. But then you notice over time, okay, it seems like things are really ramping up. And so I would, you know, that's why I described earlier that it does seem like throughout the world that there's a ramping up of these extreme events, where the records of the past aren't safe anymore. And even the records that are set now, you wonder how long are they going to remain on the books? How long is the new record high, all-time record high in Seattle going to last? Will it be broken by 2030, you know? Will it be 2035, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, how long can it last? It's really a ramp up.
Yeah, and I think part of the concern, part of it is how it's not just that temperatures are that were breaking temperature records around the world, but it's also how much, like some of these temperatures we're talking about in Europe or wherever. I mean, this is happening in June. This is happening, you know, earlier and earlier in the year. We're seeing, you know, heat that is just, yeah, breaking temperature records. It's happening earlier and earlier in the year. So that seems to be part of it as well, is how much earlier these things are happening, you know, seasonally. And I think that that is obviously affecting, because, I mean, it's really important for agriculture to have certain things happening at certain times of the year, certain, you know, rains come in at a certain point, the hotter parts of the season or the summer come in at a certain point. So you can kind of plant things and prepare things at certain times. And it seems that it's really difficult for farmers and people who are producing all the food that we rely on to be able to plan and actually adapt to these changes, because everything feels so unstable and so seemingly random. So you don't know when it's going to happen. And, you know, there's like massive crop failures one year, and maybe another year it's actually not that, you know, it's hard to plan ahead, it seems. And I think that that is one of the really important parts of climate disruption, is it's difficult to adapt because it's seemingly so like chaotic and random, right?
Yeah. There's definitely a lot of chaos. And I mean, for agriculture, they need any consistency and any balance between the heat and the cold, the balance between too much moisture and too little moisture. And obviously for whatever you plant, it's different. But you need whatever it is that you're planting for crops, you need to know that on average you can expect in any given year, okay, it's going to be like this, it's going to be like that. And obviously if I take a big hit, that's going to stink, but and built into a lot of countries, they have insurance and stuff like that to help people with loss if there's loss. But even insurance depends on the affordability of insurance, and the profitability of being an insurance company depends on the level of consistency as well. Right. That you expect, okay, you're going to pay out, but on the whole, you're going to be making a profit, and you won't be failing as a company because the climate changes are so bad, or so the climate is so chaotic that you can't even do the business you want to do, and that which would then affect the ability of farmers to have any sort of fallback financially if their crops were to fail in a particular year. So there's a lot of interconnections that go on between climate, you know, and the economy, and you know, and the ability for people to depend on things to be going a certain way, you know, on average in any given year. And obviously, if things are great, that's great. If things aren't so great, that's bad. But you could depend. Okay, well, next year will probably be better. In a couple of years, it'll get better. But with climate, with a chaotic climate that's warming, and warming at a faster rate, you know, how can you possibly depend on consistency, because you're getting all of these inconsistent impacts that you can't, that are difficult to predict, you know, you really can't do that. And so that's why humanity should probably be doing better to stop climate change to the best of their ability, or slow it down to the best of their ability. But that does not, you know, that does not seem to be it's talked about a lot that we should be doing that as a global civilization, we should be doing more, but what we're actually doing doesn't really seem to be having much effect. Everything's getting worse.
Yeah, it's there's a lot of intersecting things happening, because it just seems like at a time when we need incredible will to make enormous changes and sort of radically reimagine how we engage with our planet, how we have relationship with the earth, how we conceive of economics and and you know, politics. It's just like the very systems that brought us to this point are not being thoroughly, they're not going to change, they're actually getting worse. Yeah. And it seems like we're moving even further and buckle, well, I say we, but the political systems, the economic system itself is holding on even tighter to the paradigms that got us into this crisis to begin with. So instead of drawing down carbon emission, we're going to increase carbon emissions because we need more oil, because oil prices are so high right now. We need more oil yeah. production. You have the, you know, the war in Ukraine is causing all of these agricultural issues in you know, the food supply, the you know, distribution of various agricultural products across Europe and the, you know, the rest of the world. And also, of course, it's affecting oil. You know, inflation is extremely high right now. So what seems to be happening as things get more difficult for the average person, right, is, you know, things are really expensive right now. Like trying to yeah. go and buy like basic food items has just skyrocketed yeah. over the past several months. Gas again is extremely high. Most of us need to drive to work because we live in a country built around that. So my point is like it's really hard for us to imagine anything changing politically in addressing obviously this existential crisis when we feel like our, you know, have to tighten our belts and we have to really think about like immediate concerns of survival. And so it's this really tough bind that we're in. And I don't know if there's a question here for you. I just want to comment on the situation that we're all in, where we're trying to survive and pay rent and pay the bills and just survive in an economy like this while the planet is on fire. And we obviously should be doing things to mitigate that to the best of our ability. Yeah. But it's a hell of a time to be alive, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. We see this, this issue in, emergency management. For those that don't know, I'm a PhD student in EM. You know, the thing with emergency management is that there's these disasters and these catastrophes, but they're not caused by nature. They're caused by the vulnerabilities that society had in place prior to nature mm-hmm. coming in and sort of removing the blanket or removing the clothes and revealing the problems that existed before mm-hmm. before the hazard agent entered the human environment. And so, you know, because of that, a lot of the issues that revolve around trying to improve the disaster experience for people and really reduce the risk of disasters even happening involves a lot of social and societal issues that are largely left unaddressed, you know, mm-hmm. you know, issues, you know, regarding the rights and access to access to resources for people who happen to be poorer, you know, right. That's a big one. A lot of racial and ethnic strife in a lot of countries. I mean, we talk about the issue of race in America, but there's a lot of countries where a lot of people that are in minority religions or minority ethnic groups suffer all the time, you know, mm-hmm. struggle all the time. What do you think people think happens in a disaster when you get a hurricane or you get an earthquake or a volcanic eruption or some other event that disrupts society, causes societal disruption, damages the environment, damages the built environment? You know, mm-hmm. what happens? Well, maybe in the immediate wake of the disaster, you get a lot of altruism. You get people helping people. That's very normal. That's very well documented for, you know, past 60, 70 years of disaster research. Right. But then the struggles come after the disaster, right. the immediate effects of it and recovery, and people will many times struggle to get the help that they need because of these pre-existing issues in society that were never addressed before. And either in terms of recovering from what happened or being able to have a state of readiness for the next event, which is, you know, or reduce the risk of having something happen in the next event. And so, you know, a lot of these social justice issues, a lot of societal issues that you were just talking about at the beginning of the program that you say you've been having a lot of shows about, those things spill over into the issue of disasters, you know? I mean, you know, reproductive rights, for example, you know, the right to decide whether you want to bear, you know, children or not, you know, control your reproduction. You know, that's an economic, that's a social issue, economic issue, and that ultimately affects what you would do and how you'd respond and how your ability to recover in say disaster events. I mean, all of these things have interconnections, all these societal problems have connections. And so, you know, those that are in political power or in power or these power structures that really refuse to address these long-term either social issues or the science that's telling them that the more carbon you dump into the atmosphere, the hotter the planet's going to get, and the more impacts you're going to have, the physical, more, you know, impacts you're going to have from these physical agents, this heat, this heavy rainfall, these things that are going to, you know, cause effects, the more harm you're going to cause people, particularly people that were already being harmed or disadvantaged all the time in day-to-day social life. And so, you know, what are you going to do about that? And so far, I mean, we have the Paris Agreement, we have the Sendai Framework, we have all of these things that talk about, you know, trying to deal with climate change and deal with disaster risk reduction. But at the end of the day, you're not really seeing enough movement that really, really gets at the transformative changes that are necessary to really do the things that are required to reduce risk to people and to ecosystems and to protect what we need in order to survive on this planet, you know? So, I mean, it's kind of a thing where, you know, I know, you know, a lot of people go after or attack people who are kind of doomish and stuff. I know Michael Mann has had a big thing over the years with his, you know, anti-doom, talk, you know, and not wanting to go down that route. And I understand his perspective on that, but at the same time, I can't blame people for going down that route when you see these political and social structures that seem unmoved, you know, they seem unmoved by what we're seeing. It's like they don't, like those that run the world, I guess, you know, the wealthiest among us, they don't realize that even they are at risk, you know, even if their risk, like right now, is much lower than, say, you know, say the poorest person in the poorest country in the world, they are still at risk. Everyone on the planet is at risk. So at least care about yourself enough to care about everybody else. But so far, the movement has been very weak relative to what is needed.
Right. Yeah, this sort of reminds me of, I mean, there's a lot of, maybe there isn't as much discussion as there should be, but there is discussion around tactics of addressing all these things, right? How to face the fact that the oil industry is continuing the operations without really any impediment. There's nothing that's stopping them from exploring and extracting oil. They are setting up new wells all the time. Well, seemingly, I guess they stopped during the pandemic, the beginning of the pandemic. They had to stop because production was slowing down as a result of slowing in demand. But now oil prices are going up, and now they're, you know, all the political forces are starting to, like, say, get more oil out. And, you know, I don't know. It's a whole thing. But The thing that I was thinking of, Andreas Malm wrote a book called How to Blow Up a Pipeline or something like that, and sort of challenging some of the common ways in which we talk about climate disruption and climate activism. You know, at what point are we going to start being more disruptive of the infrastructure, you know, and actually go after the very mechanisms that are producing the crisis to begin with more directly, and sort of these sort of more pacifistic, more passive ways of protesting. And I'm not trying to put words in your mouth or suggest that this is what you're saying, but I just think, you know, at what point is there sort of a recognition in the population that, you know, this is producing this crisis of, it's so impossible to imagine how bad it's going to get. And it's already bad. We're already just, what, 1.2, maybe more, see above pre-industrial temperatures, baseline temperatures now. We're already seeing these incredible heat waves, these, you know, extreme weather events with hurricanes and flooding and drought. And of course, there's a lot of other things going on too, with just the ways that human civilization, industrial civilization, has transformed and kind of terraformed in many ways the earth in its image. So there's a combination of things happening that is producing the effects that we're experiencing now. But that being said, like, I'll tie this into the Roe v. Wade thing, just because I think this is really applicable. We are seeing an attack on reproductive rights. It's happening right in front of us. Obviously, the Supreme Court has made this decision in the United States. This is a part of an agenda. This is a long-term goal of the GOP and the right, okay? What has been done to stop that from happening has been, what, signing petitions and maybe going on social media talking about it. You know, as much as we're talking about it now, like, this isn't action. This is just discussion. And that's great. It's good to have these things. But there has to be a certain point where it's recognized that your enemy, the ones that are destroying the planet actively, that are wanting to continue the paradigm of fossil fuel dominance and destruction of the natural world, which we're all complicit in, but some are actively like, we need to keep this going because this is the way it should be, and we believe in our dominance on this planet, and we need to protect that and perpetuate it. At what point do we recognize that these people are very well motivated? They have all these resources at their disposal. They've stacked all the courts and all the positions of political power in their favor. You know, at what point are we going to step up and say, like, the political system isn't going to stop this? It's never been designed to stop it. And, you know, at least in addressing just not just mitigation, but adaptation, when you're talking about disasters that are playing out, like, we're just not prepared, even just on a preparation level, we're just not prepared for the climate disruption that's occurring, the heat waves and everything that's happening. Like, we're just not prepared, and we need to really start actively thinking about what action looks like in light of all these things that are occurring. Yeah. And again, I don't want to put you in a position where you're like, I'm not advocating for all this stuff. I just want to articulate for myself, like, at what point, I mean, where's the breaking point here? Like, at what point are we going to just start doing something? And I don't know what that always looks like, because I'm not a strategic, you know, I'm not thinking at, I'm not, you know, planning this or involved in this in a direct level. I just want to be kind of voicing this sort of sentiment I think a lot of us are having right now, which is like, where's the breaking point for us? When do we realize that the systems are not going to do anything to stop it? In fact, are just perpetuating the problem, you know?
It's hard to say. And I think it might come to a head where you have people that start getting, you know, desperate and angry because what choice have you left them?
Exactly.
you know, nobody cares, you know, seems to care about their needs and interests. And I mean, you almost saw this in the 1950s and 60s before I was in the United States, where you had, obviously, you had, you know, some that wanted to take a more peaceful route and others that wanted to take a more militant route. And which way is the right route, you know?
Right.
Which way is the right way to take? Can you trust that the system's going to do something for you, or, you know, and revise itself? Or do you actually fight the system? And
right,
and I mean it and obviously Martin Luther King Jr., who, you know, I remember my family that knew Martin Luther King Jr. Personally, and then, you know, Malcolm X had these debates about this
right.
pretty sure. strongly. But I mean, yeah, I mean, it's hard to know what's going to happen. I don't know what to do or say. It just seems like things right. get worse, and yet we do, you know, we meaning those with the power to really change something, refuse to act, or we even worse, we go 10 steps backwards. I wrote a post on my personal Facebook page about the Roe v. Wade stuff and some of the threats now to gay marriage and same-sex marriage and some other constitutional rights. Like, oh, go 2 steps forward and 10 steps backward into the Stone Age.
Yes.
You know, it's just like, what are you going to do, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, what are you going to do, threaten? I mean, that's why I sometimes look at, I know about, you know, obviously, like, the death of George Floyd galvanized a lot of people. But, I mean, realistically, in terms of Black people in the United States, has there really been any meaningful change in the past couple of years since he died? Like meaningful change in terms of, like, do we have reparations?
Right.
No,
right.
We don't. We don't have reparations. You know, has our socioeconomics structure changed? Not really.
No.
Do I still feel like I have to worry? Every time you might get stopped by a cop, probably. You know, has cop culture changed? You know, I mean, I'm not saying, and I, you know, I don't want to put down people that believe in the power of protest. I mean, power of protest has done a lot in this country, you know, just standing up, speaking out, and refusing to back down, you know, that's power, you know. I was in protests against the Afghanistan war when it was unpopular to be against the Afghanistan war, and certainly against the Iraq war, and obviously George Floyd's death galvanized a lot of people and got people to actually start talking about and talking back to people that refuse to acknowledge or address the problems of race in this country, but the actual structural problems remain.
Right.
They haven't gone away, you know?
Right.
And so those structural problems bleed off into lots of different things. It's an issue with climate change. It's an issue with emergency management. It's an issue with just being able to feel like you can thrive, thrive and flourish in your society, you know?
Yeah.
You know, those are the things that really have to be changed, and they don't get addressed. We just sort of, particularly the majority population, whether the population of power tends to, they might chatter about it, and then it gets glossed over, and we move on to the next thing again, the next breaking news.
Right. Yeah. We're in kind of a cycle of being shocked and appalled by some new thing that's happening. And then, for example, is the spat of mass shootings that we've had. I've talked about on the podcast. The one in Uvalde was the one in Buffalo was obviously extremely appalling for a lot of reasons because it was a racially motivated attack.
Yeah.
The one in Uvalde was just very obviously upsetting for a couple reasons. One is obviously children were being targeted, but you know the police response was just abysmal to say the least. So there's just this combination of things that's happening where I think our attention is being drawn all these different directions, pulled in different directions. And I think it has the effect of creating almost a sense of despair, right? And I think the feeling that the supposed democratic institutions that are meant to address social issues or whatever are not being addressed and they can't be addressed anymore or at all. You know, it's kind of it can feel like we're experiencing a real sense of complacency around it. But our survival really depends on, especially on the climate issue. It really does depend on us finding something that makes sense, you know, that is, you know, we're talking about this tension in the civil rights movement between more direct action that may be considered not nonviolent and then the more pacifistic approach. I think like with Martin Luther King and I think with Malcolm X, I think with a lot of these figures that seem like they were opposing each other, and maybe at certain points in their lives they were, but it seems like towards the end of their lives, before they were assassinated, there was actually, they were coming to a place of like reconciliation and understanding, like it's not about one is better than the other. It really is contextual and really depends on what makes most sense in certain circumstances. So, you know, at a certain point, you got to ask, like, when is it that we really do need to do certain things that may be considered more confrontational regarding climate change, right? Because we're way past the point where, you know, some of the worst effects of climate disruption can be stopped, right? Some of the worst effects of it are not going to be mitigated. We can certainly learn to adapt to some of it, but we need to really start thinking about what does it look like to be in a place where a heat wave lasts 2 months? And what are the ways in which we can not only survive those things, but learn to, I don't know, like what does adaptation look like in that circumstance, you know? And I think, the systems as they are now are not equipped to deal with that. So I think, yeah, there's some really big and difficult questions that need to be asked. And if there's even any answers to them, but something like an answer can come out of that. We need to really, and I think people are doing that. I think that's starting to happen. I think that the quickening of climate disruptive events and the disruption it's causing in social and political and economic life is, it's staggering.
Yeah, it is. And you know, when you look at, you know, right now it is 2022 and people are wondering, you know, what the world's going to look like in say 2040 or 2050. I mean, that's not very far away.
No.
At all. It's 20 years ago this month that I graduated from high school, and it seems like it was yesterday.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's going to fly by. Mm-hmm. It's probably going to fly by even faster with all of these changes in climate and society and politics and everything else that's going on. So, you know, I think coming years, people are going to be making decisions about what they're going to do to deal with all of these situations. And I could easily see more militant climate action. I could see people starting to abandon certain areas, you know, in mm-hmm. various countries because they get hit by so many events that recovery is right. not, you know, their sense of recovery is not going to be staying in the same place, facing the same hazard that's getting worse, pounding them every couple of years. It's going to be, I have to go somewhere else now, you know, because I can't stay here. Mm-hmm. And then there's going to be issues where, all right, people are moving. How do you maintain the right, you know, protect the rights of those people to be able to move to another place and be able to thrive versus the people that are already in those places trying to thrive themselves? You know, it's going to be a big issue with the so-called global south, where people are going to be moving in, you know, from say, you know, central South America, moving more poleward, trying to get away from all the heat and the drought, the tropics, and you know, facing other countries that may not, because it's going to be a humanitarian crisis, and humanitarian crises are notoriously complex, and there's a lot of complex issues, and a lot of it will be tribalism, where people may or may not want to include them in their societies, and there's going to be fighting over that. Some of it not so peaceful, perhaps. So, I mean, I mean, so you're going to be dealing with a lot of issues, you know, as the temperature rises, as the seas rise, as storms get worse or the droughts get worse. And no matter what we do, there's some climate change that's baked in already. So some of this stuff that we're talking about is going to happen. And it's just a matter of are we as humans in our, the way we handle our politics and our social frameworks, are we actually going to choose to, the path of doing things the way that they just need to be done to, for the betterment of people, and do it peacefully, or are we going to fight each other? I don't know. I don't have the answer to that. My brain is telling me it's going to be more on the fighting side, but my hopes and dreams are telling me to hope for the best.
Sure. I mean, over the course of doing this podcast, I think I've explored both sides of this, because I think it's not one thing. I do think, you know, in cases of whatever, you know, whatever disasters have emerged, there are examples, as you've talked about, of people do, you know, people are willing to help each other. That does happen. But also some of the pre-existing social divides and tensions, racial, you know, racism and so on, like these things really do get aggravated and become part of the picture as well. So we can't pretend that that's not also going to happen. We have to be able to understand that human nature is a complex thing, and it's really dependent on the culture that you're part of, the society that you're in, et cetera. There's a lot of factors to consider when we think about what does it look like when Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans and in that region, a lot of things happened. There was some really bad stuff that happened. There was some, obviously, some people also described, you know, how people organize and were very effective in organizing. I mean, the same thing happened when I think it was Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico some years ago. Similar, well, you know, obviously the infrastructure was just not prepared for that. So there was no electricity and no running water for a period of time. And it, considering it is a part of the, I don't know what you want to call it, the Commonwealth or whatever, the United States is basically a colonial asset. Mm-hmm. The U.S. was just not dealing with it in an effective way. And the people there were just like, well, we'll take care of each other the best that we possibly can. So it can go in different directions. And I think we need to be prepared and really have a really sober look at the landscape, right? So looking at what the United States is right now and living in the U.S. particularly, what does it look like when our systems don't function as we think they're supposed to function? What does it look like when a climate disruptive event occurs and there is a massive heat wave or flooding or whatever it is, and we, you know, have to really start thinking about survival? What does that look like? You know, and I think this is the time especially to start really thinking about what that looks like and what does it look like for you to sort of get through those events the best way you can? You know, like yesterday I was just looking up like, okay, food prices are really high right now. I would like to have food if I can't afford it. So I'm like, let's see, I can afford getting stocks of certain things. So how do I prepare, like how do I store certain dry foods? Like how can I, like beans or certain grains or, you know what I mean? Like rice, like how would I store that? And I was just looking up stuff and I'm like, yeah, I could budget this. I can figure this out. So it's like little things that we can do on an individual level. There's obviously connections we can make on a community level that are very important as well, if not more important. I think this conversation really just points to what's happening right now and what's going to happen. And we just have to look at that very clearly and very soberly and then act accordingly, because, you know, it's happening. I don't know what else to ask or to add. I think this conversation or this discussion, this interview or discussion, whatever you want to call it, with you has been really great for me. I really look forward to whenever we have a conversation, Nick. And it's interesting to see the directions that you've gone professionally over the past few years. Could you talked about disaster preparedness that you're engaged with now? Could you talk about that a little bit?
My PhD is am working on right now. I'm going into my second year as an emergency management disaster science. So it's looking at emergency management and the phases of emergency management, preparedness, response, recovery, and mitigation, and also just looking at the theoretical framework for emergency management.
So
right now I'm doing my sort of focus is in individual household response to warnings. And I'm also specializing in individual household preparedness in the U.S. context. But my focus would probably be my dissertation research will revolve around warning. So basically any event that has forewarning where you know it's coming in the short term and be able to warn people and understanding a human response to warnings, how people respond and the things they can do and the challenges that they face responding to hazard events. So that's sort of my interest. And because I came from the meteorology realm, obviously. And meteorologists deal with warnings, especially in the U.S., deal with actually issuing and communicating warnings for meteorological hazards. So that's my interest. And hopefully I'll be able to be a social scientist working for the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration or for the National Weather Service. That's my goal, trying to sort of get my foot in the door with the Weather Service so I can have some place with them after I graduate. I'm supposed to graduate in spring of 2024, so 2 years from now I'll be done.
Well, it's good to know you, and it's good to, of course, have you back on the podcast. It's also great to know just the trajectory of your life, of your career, of where you're going. You know, you're always, you know, you didn't settle on one thing. You're kind of like moving in a certain direction. It's interesting to see where that's going. So thank you for sharing that. And I'm excited to see where this goes with you. And again, I think you provide a great service to all of us, those that follow you on Facebook. I think you're also on like Twitter as well, maybe in other places, but you definitely have a Patreon. I'll be pitching that at the in the introduction of this episode too, so people can support your work there. And Nick, thank you so much for taking the time to have this interview.
Yeah, it was great to be on finally. I always like, you were one of the first to really like talk about the flooding in Nebraska, Iowa a few years ago. And when it wasn't getting much attention, and it was good to be on the podcast the past few times and talk to you about, you know, flooding to the Arctic, to the fires and everything that's going on around the world. Now I can talk about EM stuff too.
I mean, you know, it's good. It's for me, my attention gets pulled in all these different directions, and I'm just one person producing and putting this podcast together. I feel like I'm experiencing the limits of what one person can do with one thing like this, and I feel that I neglect certain subjects sometimes. So sometimes it's like I'm really focused on the climate, other times I'm focused on other things. It's hard to it would be great if I had a team of people, you know, that I could just like help me organize this thing a bit better, but I'm doing the best I can with what I have. And so, yeah, I'm glad that I was able to cover that subject when we did back in 2019 and to talk about what we talked about today. So anyway, I'll be directing people to your Patreon and all of the other websites that are relevant to this discussion. So Nick, thanks again for the time, and we'll do this again soon, I'm sure.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Hey, everybody. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Last Born in the Wilderness. If you would like to learn more about my work, you can go to my website, lastborninthewilderness.com. Everything you need to know will be there. If you would like to support my work, there are a few ways to do that. The first thing you can do, of course, is subscribe to this podcast. This podcast is on numerous platforms, so wherever you listen to podcasts, it should be there. So consider subscribing. And if you'd like to support this work monetarily, there are a few ways to do that. The first is through a one-time donation through PayPal and Venmo. Go to paypal.me/lastbornpodcast. Or you can find me on Venmo at lastbornpodcast. And if you would like to support my work on a regular basis, on a monthly or yearly basis, you can do that through Patreon. Go to patreon.com/lastborninthewilderness. And if you support my work there, you will gain early access to these interviews before I release them publicly. You will find other exclusive content there as well. So to everyone that is a supporter of my podcast, however you choose to do that, thank you very, very much. If you would like to leave an audio message that can be featured on the podcast, you can do that through two means. You can call the phone number 208-918-2837 and leave a message up to 3 minutes long. Please let me know what your intention is with the message so that I can then choose to feature it or not feature it on the podcast. If you would like to also just go to my website, lastbornthewilderness.com, you'll find a link at the top of the page that'll let you drop an audio file if that is preferable. And that is it, everybody. Thank you so much again for listening to this episode of Last Born in the Wilderness. Have a great week.